And I really wanted to look at why they were doing this, despite the possibility for stigmatization in our society, that especially with leisure activities like quilt making, it really seems to be gender-based. There's somehow something is appropriate for men to do or appropriate for women to do. And there are all these societal rules that we're apparently supposed to follow. But these men were not following those rules. And so I wanted to know, does this fulfill any basic psychological needs for them? And so their motivations were often about self-empowerment, well-being. So they enjoyed what they were doing. There was no one forcing them to make quilts.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive deep into the minds shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe innovation happens in all aspects of life. I am your host, Dr. Yolanda Sanders. Today, we have the pleasure of hosting Dr. Aaron French, an educator, instructional designer, and historian who is profoundly dedicated to fostering quality education globally. Since 2006, Dr. French has been instrumental in enhancing learning experiences at Iowa State University and now at A.T. Still University, where she serves as an instructional designer focused on faculty development. Dr. French's academic journey is marked by a rich tapestry of experiences, beginning with a BA in History and Art from Simpson College, followed by an MPhil in Decorative Arts and Design in History from the University of Glasgow. Her research during this time explored the architectural transformation of Glasgow's Pollock House, deepening her expertise in historical and object-based research. After a significant tenure in Scotland, working with museum services and archives, Dr. French returned to the U.S. to advance international education. At Iowa State University, she led the creation of the Global Human Sciences minor and prepared over 1,500 students for transformative study abroad experiences. Her commitment to the field was recognized through her role in the Forum on Education Abroad, where she contributed to developing the standards of good practice for education abroad. In 2021, Dr. French earned her PhD with a dissertation exploring men's narratives in quilt making from 1970 to 2020. This work has broadened the scope of quilt scholarship and contributed to a more inclusive understanding of textile arts. Dr. French's current work is infused with a global citizenship mindset. It aims to promote curiosity, empathy, respectful communication, and positive change, with a passionate focus on achieving the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal. 4. Quality education. Her research continues to explore the intersection of material culture and well-being through textile-based leisure activities. Outside of her professional life, Dr. French is an avid quilt maker, antique collector, and bird watcher. She dedicates time to researching the life of the inventor William H. Silver and uncovering the stories behind the innovations that have shaped our world. We are excited to learn more about Dr. French's journey and the impact of her work on global education and material culture. Aaron, it's wonderful to have you on Innovation Insights. So happy to have you here.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to be a guest. I really appreciate it.
Well, we've known each other now, what, has it been about 10 years, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I started working in the College of Human Sciences at Iowa State in 2015. So yeah, it's been about 10 years.
It has been 10 years. And then we also both are alumna of University of Nebraska, too. So, which I didn't realize that for a long time. And I was like, oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yeah, I was fortunate to take some of my quilt studies courses there as I was pursuing my doctorate at Iowa State. I was able to transfer those credits.
Yeah, well, that's fabulous. And then I ended up being your dissertation advisor. So thank you for still talking to me. And
oh, of course. I appreciate your mentorship.
Oh, well, we had a lot of laughter during it. And it was just a joy working with you and collaborate, you know, either, you know, in your role when you were at Iowa State and then, you know, as when you were working on your dissertation. Just fabulous. So why don't we start with you just telling us a little bit about your background and your journey. How did you get to where you are now?
Well, I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in history. And I think I probably had an antiques collection before I was 12 years old. It was just something that was supported in our household. There was a huge interest in family history. And I think that's really where it started. And then wondering, well, what would those times be like when my ancestors were living? And what objects would they have had? And so we had some things that were passed down through the family that I still have that I treasure. Some, they're, you know, what I have left of my family, of some people, of course, from generations back that I never knew. And also art was very important growing up. My mom drew, she painted, and later she took ceramics classes. And so those items were around our home as well. And then when I went to college, I had the opportunity to take an art history course my first year. And that really changed things for me because I could see that art was a way to preserve and document history. It was just one of the many ways that that could be done. We usually think about history as being written, but of course, there are lots of other ways that history comes to us. And so I took every art class, every history class that I could fit in to my schedule when I was at Simpson College. And I also had the opportunity to take two semesters of British history and the culmination of that, participate in a study abroad program to England and Scotland. So that was 3 weeks there at the conclusion of my sophomore year. And as soon as I got back, I was like, I have to be able to go there again. And so I started seriously considering pursuing a master's degree abroad. And with Title IV federal funding, there are schools abroad that will take American financial aid. So I was able to fund my master's degree with loans, and I studied decorative arts and design history at the University of Glasgow. And that degree included vocational training to work in auction houses or stately homes or museums. And there were a lot of connections. We would go to museums for handling sessions. We would go to the auction house to learn how the business was run. And so after graduation, I was able to work in the museums and heritage industry in Scotland. But after 5 years, I was a little bit homesick. You know, I was far away from my family. And so I came back to the United States. And of course, I was looking for jobs in museums and heritage here. But my parents had been faculty members. And so I was also looking at universities for employment. And that's when I came across a program coordinator position in the College of Design at Iowa State University. And it was to coordinate study abroad programs. And so I could combine living abroad for 5 years with my, you know, my study abroad program experience, as well as working in an art and design atmosphere. And so that position, I think, was perfectly made for me, combining a lot of my interests and allowed me to grow by concentrating on my strengths as well. And then, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I also worked in the College of Human Sciences. That was as Director of International Programs. And then about a year and a half ago, I decided to change course and really focus on instructional design. I've been doing more and more of that in my position in the College of Human Sciences and decided that I wanted to make that full-time switch.
Yeah, well, and I know that I've had experiences with you because when you were in your doctoral program, you did some of your student teaching aspect of doctoral programs. And so Erin worked with me in a grad course that I had. And I'm so thankful that she did because I was department chair at the same time. And generally, department chairs do not teach such a heavy load of courses. And I was, though. And so her instructional design abilities with that and use of technology And because also this was during the pandemic too that she was doing this. So I was not surprised when, you know, you made that evolution, because you're just really naturally good at that too.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to work with you that summer. We had to suddenly change the course that, that both you and I knew from 2 years earlier when I took it as a student, and then changing it for online and connecting with students who were spread across the United States.
Yes, because that was summer of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, you know, I was department chair. And so there was just, you know, a few other things.
You just had a couple other things going on.
A huge department. And so I was so thankful to have you, and I really leaned on you to, you know, help get us through all of that. So thank you. But you know, I want to go back to your time in Scotland for a little bit, because I've not been to Glasgow, but I know a faculty there. I know other faculty that have taught there. I know some students that were exchange students from Glasgow to Iowa State at one point. And tell me just a little bit about that experience. And for our audience, because I think, you know, sometimes, you know, people don't think about living abroad for a while or studying abroad, or they might be curious about it, but, you know, not sure, you know, what that's like.
Well, I think a great entry point into living abroad is studying abroad, where there's support for you as part of that program. And then you get to start to integrate yourself. You mentioned that exchange program. Iowa State had that with Glasgow Caledonian University. And so students could go for an entire semester and take courses as a GCU student would, while someone from GCU was coming to Iowa State to do the same thing. And so at the master's level, I wasn't part of an exchange. It was a direct enroll, and it wasn't associated with any university here. I enrolled there as an international student. And, you know, that department was wonderful for providing support. I learned so much while I was there, so much that, you know, I wanted to stay and work in that industry, applying directly what I had learned during my degree. So living in the city was an amazing experience for someone who is from a small town of 3,000 or 4,000 people. And the Scottish people, especially in Glasgow, are extremely welcoming. They're extremely friendly. And so I was really accepted. I suppose it didn't hurt that I have Scottish heritage as well. But everyone there was really supportive and welcoming. And I really treasured my time working in the museums and heritage industry for North Lanarkshire Council. Getting to know that local area was really important for me settling in. So, you know, I had access to the history of the area at work, and just found it very fascinating to learn about the life and times of people prior to me arriving.
Well, and you know, since you have Scottish heritage, was that the reason why you chose Scotland?
That was one of the reasons. Like I said, family history was really important growing up. And so to think about being there and maybe walking where my ancestors had was very interesting. I have other heritage as well, but for some reason there was just some hook with Scotland that was really interesting to me, and just that I wanted to experience living there.
Oh, that's cool. I love it. And I love that you really do weave in history and genealogy and family into everything you do. And it seems to be a core value. Those are core values of yours. So, and in thinking about that, your research is really fascinating. And all of those themes also came up within your research too. Even though the topic was quilt making, but I was for the audience. I was, as her major professor, I also was her audit coder. So I was involved with some of the analysis of her dissertation research. So you know, just reflecting on some of that as you were talking, you know, about family, and that was something that did come up too. So, but tell us about your dissertation and quilt making.
So my dissertation topic was men who quilt. And I did take a historical perspective on it during the Great American Quilt Revival that started in the early 1970s and continues until today. And I had the honor and the pleasure of talking to 15 men who quilt. We did interviews not unlike this. They were based around the country in 12 different states. And I talked to them for about 1 to 5 hours. And really, it was the same set of questions, but some were a lot more talkative than others. And they really gave me a lot of insights into why a band would be interested in quilt making. We don't expect that. We expect textile-based leisure activities to really be the purview of women. But I think my research shows that quilt making can be for everyone.
Well, and why did you decide to choose quilt making to study?
So I think that it was a family influence again. My cousin Ruby had made quilts, and when she needed to go into the nursing home in, I think it was 2007 or 2008, I thought that she might like a quilt for a little bit more comforts of home. Unfortunately, we'd had to sell a lot of her things. We were unable to keep all of her quilts, although I still do have some of them. And so I made her one. And I think that experience, you know, has really stayed with me, that I could support a family member with something that she loved. And it gave us hours and hours of conversation. Listening to her really inspired me. Now, I didn't have a lot of extra time laying around, so I haven't been making quilts constantly since 2008. But with apparel and textiles, studying that, I've always been way more interested on the textiles side of it. So I think with those family influences and my interest in making things, those came together that I really wanted to concentrate on quilt making for what I was studying.
How do you feel that being a quilt maker and informed your research and your ability to interview these men who quilt?
So quilt making is taking smaller pieces of things and putting them together to form something new, a new object. And so I kind of think of the interview process as something like that. My questions are the quilt top pieces, and I'm stitching them together as I'm talking to someone to make that quilt top, to make their interview.
What a wonderful analogy. Wonderful analogy. Oh, this reminds me, you know, how brilliant you are. Okay.
Well, thanks.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Well, tell us a little bit about the men who quilt and why. And I know that you just recently had a journal article published about this, too. And we'll make sure that there's a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, so Uncommon Threads, Motivations of Men Who Quilt, was recently published online by Clothing and Textiles Research Journal. I think they're about 1 or 2 years behind for the print version. So, you know, look for that in 2026 or 2027. But yeah, the article really focused on the motivations of men who quilt. And I really wanted to look at why they were doing this, despite the possibility for stigmatization in our society, that especially with leisure activities like quilt making, it really seems to be gender-based. There's somehow something is appropriate for men to do or appropriate for women to do. And there are all these societal rules that we're apparently supposed to follow, but these men were not following those rules. And so I wanted to know, does this fulfill any basic psychological needs for them? And so their motivations were often about self-empowerment, well-being. So they enjoyed what they were doing. There was no one forcing them to make quilts. It wasn't like maybe they were with a wife or a sister or something and just got, you know, made to do it. It wasn't anything like that. Sometimes others in their family did make quilts. And I mean, like, you know, a wife or a daughter or something like that. But a lot of them came to it on their own as well. It was also around the self-care benefits. They talked about it being a meditative experience. I recall one of the narrators said that he liked the sound of the sewing machine, that was very meditative for him. Another narrator said that he liked to sit down and make the same block over and over again. Just that repetitive process was calming for him. Another point of motivation for them was competency. So the skill development. So moving from maybe a really basic quilt to doing something where there would be curves or they would be making their own patterns. And also their ability to solve problems. So if you're making your own quilt, you don't have a pattern. So you have to make your own solutions too. But also even with a basic pattern, what happens when something goes wrong? What happens when you stitch something a little bit crooked or your bobbin runs out in the middle of what you're sewing? You have problems to solve. And so how they could stretch themselves, stretch their creativity to solve those problems with quilt making was also a motivation. And then men also had social supports. So in many cases, they had friends and family, like I said, that were already making quilts or were very supportive of them doing it. Maybe they were the recipients of quilts. Maybe they just enjoyed having them as family members. You know, if you're making them for a child or making them for a friend. Also, they found a lot of support on social media. And I think that it helped them to not feel as isolated. That even if there wasn't someone in their own community who was a man who was quilting, they could find somebody else online. They could see others who looked just like them making quilts. Quilt groups and guilds were also important. Some of them were members, some of them had made presentations. And so again, helping them to feel supported. And then their ability to care for others. And I think men's care work is really important. I talked about gift giving. I think when you're making something for somebody else, you infuse yourself into that gift. And so it's a way to show love. It's a way to show caring. And I think that was really important for these men to be able to demonstrate that. And they also face stigmas as well. We talked about how there are these rules about gender-based leisure, but they were really overcoming that. The support that they had, the motivating factors that they had overcame those, the chance, the opportunity to be stigmatized, they were overcoming that. And so I think that also my research is helping to normalize the fact that men can participate in textile-based leisure, and it doesn't have to only be quilt making. I mean, there's knitting and crochet, embroidery, lace making. I'm really hoping that regardless of what someone is interested in, and it can be outside of textile-based leisure as well, you know, maybe it's rock climbing, maybe it's woodworking, that it doesn't matter who you are. It really matters what your interest is, and you should be pursuing that. I'm sure that these other hobbies, these other leisure activities, they would feel the same. Maybe woodworking is meditative for a woman. She should be able to do that. So I'm really hopeful that this research can help to normalize and help to encourage people to take up hobbies where they're making things. I think making is an incredibly important hobby.
I love that. And thanks for addressing the stigma and that it just, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are. If you enjoy doing something, then you should have that right. I mean, what advice would you give to a man who is wanting to pursue a leisure activity that's in the textile arts area?
Yeah, I would definitely encourage him to do that. I can connect him with 15 men who quilt. And, you know, maybe he wants to knit or something. I'm sure I can come up with some men who knit as well. I really think connecting with others online would be really important for that man who wants to start out. You wouldn't have to connect only with other men. I think anybody, you know, can teach you how to knit, teach you how to make a quilt. But I think those online connections are really important because they might not have those local connections. I had several of the men in my study say, well, it's only me unless you count Instagram. And then there's this other world that opens up when they sit down at the computer, they sit down at their phone. So I would really encourage them to connect with someone online. And, you know, maybe that's a teacher or mentorship sort of situation. Maybe they already know how to make a quilt, but it's more encouragement. I was thinking about this design. I was thinking about these colors. How can I do this? I think having a conversation about it with somebody else can really help with motivation and help you to actually make something that you're proud of.
Oh, that's great advice. And we were so fortunate to live in a time where access to people is so much easier, and connecting with people, you know, via social media, internet, you know, email, you know, soon we'll have, you know, virtual reality. You can just have, you know, someone pop into your room and he'll give you lessons. And one thing that we, you know, and it's really not by purpose, but just by people that I know, we've interviewed quite a few men who are makers in the textile arts. So we have Vince Cavedo, J.R. Campbell, Michael James, Tom Lundberg. I'm trying to get Rob Hillstead on here. But they're all, people too that I think could really help support that. So, you know, how do you feel that quilt making can help support other researchers, you know, your work on quilt making can help other researchers, or what's some other research that needs to happen in this area? I know that you've thought a bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think men who are participating in textile-based leisure activities need to be conducting research on other men. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm obviously not a man, but I did open this up more. I'm not the first researcher to talk to men who quilt, but my dissertation had the most participants that I could find. And so I'm hoping it can be inspiration for others. I think it's important for dispelling that stigma is to really have other men be doing the research as well. And again, it doesn't have to be solely on quilt making. There are lots of ways that men can be involved in the textile arts. So I would definitely think that's important. I also think we need to be preserving the stories of men who began making quilts or began participating in any textile-based leisure back in the 1970s. You know, those men are getting a lot older now. And I was fortunate enough to speak with three of them for my dissertation research, but I know there's a lot more out there. And their stories need to be preserved, whether that's through oral history interviews, through some sort of community-based project. It doesn't really matter. What matters is the preservation of the stories. And so I think that would also be another important part of research. Because, like I said, they're getting older and they're not going to be around for a long time to be able to share those stories.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great call to action of you know, getting these stories documented. And thank you for doing that. thank you. So what can the discipline do to help support men who quilt, men who are makers in textile arts or textile areas? What can the discipline do?
I think the discipline can help to normalize it. I think when we look at, say, an apparel program at an undergraduate institution, there might not be as many young men who are interested. Those that are, have them out there being spokespersons for it. Have them help with recruitment. And also have research like mine in the curriculum. I'm not the only one who has conducted research on men in this field. Make sure that that's being highlighted in classes. I think the encouragement of faculty members towards those students is extremely important. And I think that celebrating difference, celebrating diversity is also extremely important. We can have diversity of designs, diversity of thought. Each of these people are bringing in different backgrounds that weren't part of the field before. And I think that can only help to strengthen the field.
That was a great suggestion. So I absolutely agree. Is there anything that the retail industry can do? Because the quilting industry, it's big. It is big.
It is a $5 billion industry in the United States. So that's not worldwide. That is only in this country.
So what could that $5 billion industry do to help support men who are makers?
Well, I had several of my narrators tell me that they had had disappointing experiences in retail shops, where the assumption was that they were not the maker. That was the automatic assumption. Oh, are you shopping for your wife? Are you looking for something for your sister? Does your daughter need anything? And so I think training for retail employees is extremely important. If someone is automatically going in and being stigmatized, why would they continue to shop there? Now, admittedly, there are a lot more women who make quilts than men, but this is growing. We've seen that through exhibitions of men's work. I did not have that much trouble recruiting participants for my studies, so I know that there are lots of men who quilt out there. Why would the retail industry decide that they're going to cut out a segment of the population that's going to give them money? That doesn't make sense to me at all. So I really think the number one thing that the retail industry can do is have some diversity and inclusion training for their staff people who are customer facing, to make sure that they understand that anybody coming in can be the maker. Let them say, I'm shopping for my wife today. She wanted some fabric. Don't just simply assume that that's what they're there for.
Thank you for saying all of that, because in my days when I used to be a maker and designer, I would go to local retail stores in various, you know, states, not just where I am now, but other states that I've lived, and also get interrogated. And I don't know if the part of the training is, oh, let's ask this person what they might be making. I don't know if that is part of the customer service training or what, but half the time the questions are offensive. And if you're not answering it in a way that is what is expected, then you're like, well, really, you're going to do that with that fabric? Have you really thought about that? And I'm just so glad you bring this up, because another guest that on the podcast has mentioned this customer service and the challenges that individuals have of being welcomed within retail environments and feeling comfortable. And I could just imagine what it would be like for a man who goes into a retail environment to buy supplies and materials and not feeling comfortable.
Right. I think they might shop more online then, where they don't have to face the judgment of a clerk. I mean, why wouldn't you? I wouldn't want to go into a store and not feel welcome. I mean, but fabric shopping kind of is an in-person deal. You know, you might really want to touch that fabric before you decide to make a quilt with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and it's, you know, there's this whole trend now, or not trend, or just commentary that's happening since the pandemic, especially with Black women saying that, you know, it's safer to work at a distance because of basically toxic environments, being treated poorly, microaggressions. And this is just another example that, okay, you know, if you're not treated well as you go into a retail store, how do you shop? Okay, you just shop online, you know? And I think this is why we're seeing that, you know, the growth of businesses like Amazon, because people don't know how to treat people well. not nice to each other. So, okay, let's just all become little hermits and not go out into the world and just do what we need to do via online, which is sad.
It really is. And it's not going to do anything to dispel stigmas against men who quilt or knit or stitch.
Oh.
If they're forced to be hidden away, then we're not going to overcome this. And I think overcoming this stigma is a step to overcoming other stigmas. You know, there's, like I mentioned before, there are leisure activities where women are excluded too by society. I'm not saying by people who are who are monster truck drivers or something like that. I'm just saying that society doesn't look favorably upon gender atypical participation. So I think we work on it in one area, there's going to be gains in other areas too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we just really just need to start being nicer to people.
Yeah.
Even, I know that's...
I mean, we got this Iowa Nice thing, right? Like, maybe we ought to actually do that.
Well, I'll just take a drink on that one. Well, yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think those are really great actionable steps that people can take. And I always love from dissertation research to, you know, think about, you know, what could be applicable, because, you know, as educators, we always, you know, sometimes get critiqued of just, you know, doing work, having it in the ivory tower, publishing it just within, you know, our journals, but not sharing out, you know, some actionable steps that can be used from it. And so thank you for sharing those.
You're welcome. And I just really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you, because I can bet a lot of your readers have access to Clothing and Textiles Research Journal, but a lot don't. And so they're not necessarily going to be able to get access to this article that was published, you know, unless they've got some sort of a university connection. So I appreciate that I can get my research out there without someone needing something that's behind a paywall.
Good point. Good point. Good point. Well, you know, I think, you know, you're an excellent researcher, and you know, we'll have to talk about some more ideas of ways to disseminate and spread the word from your dissertation. So what are some of the next steps for you? I know you have some projects that you're working on, and I want to have you back to discuss one of them.
So professionally, in terms of research, now that I'm part of a teaching and learning center, we have some research projects that we're working on. I'm not the principal investigator on any of the ones that I'm currently involved with, so I'm not really sure what I can share about them at this point. But teaching and learning focused, working with faculty and students on issues in teaching and learning. So I can really see my research turning towards that to match up with my current career trajectory.
Okay. Well, that's great. That's great. Well, I have other ideas for you too, but, you know, I'll keep bringing you back. So I know you really have a global perspective about work and the world and history. So would you talk a little bit about that and, you know, global citizenship and education, just your thoughts on that, because that's been a huge part of your career too.
Yeah, it has been. I worked at Iowa State for 17 years in education abroad. And over the years, I came to realize that I was approaching the world with a global citizenship mindset. And that involves global thinking dispositions, that I approach things with curiosity. I also approach others with empathy. I do that through respectful communication, and I also advocate for positive change. And so I really try to ground myself in those principles. And that's how I'm dealing with people on an everyday basis. I think all of that can help with customer service. It can help to make connections with people, and it can help me to help them do their jobs better. That's what I'm working with faculty right now, to help them with course design, with educational technology, with evidence-based teaching, and with educational research. And so keeping all of that in mind with all of my communications and interactions helps me to help them.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great. Thank you for that work. And for a young college student, what would be your advice for them to, you know, maybe they can't afford to study abroad, but they're interested in the global world. What could they do? What would your suggestions be for them?
So I think they can travel through the courses that they're taking without leaving campus. At any university anywhere, you are going to find global focused courses. And so, you know, you can travel by learning about world religions. You can travel by learning about world history. You can travel about learning about art around the world. And so even if you are still in your dorm room with your nose in a book, you can be somewhere else, because those resources are going to connect you with people in another time and another place. So I really hope that people can travel, but I know that's not a possibility for everyone. Mm-hmm. So it's looking for the types of coursework on campus. And it could also be looking for opportunities in your own community. I know at Iowa State, there's an English Together program where people get together and help others to learn English. Well, you can connect with people from around the world there and learn about their cultures, learn about their history, learn about their art, all while sitting in a coffee shop in Iowa. So I think it's important for students to be looking on campus as well as off campus in their own communities.
That's great. That was great. What if someone is not, because we have some viewers too that are not connected to colleges or universities. What are some ways that someone could do it if they don't have that access to even a university?
Yeah, I would really emphasize those community connections. In many cities and towns, there's going to be some sort of organization. You know, it could be related to a church. It could be related to a grocery store, something where they're going to have the opportunity to meet people from other cultures and other places. And if that's not possible in your own community, and, you know, I assume most of your listeners have internet connections. So it's looking for those connections online. You can do that through something as simple as Instagram.
Absolutely. Yeah. Instagram, LinkedIn. You know, there's some of my guests that we just became connected via LinkedIn. Some people, there's one guest that we're doing a four-part series on a book that she's written. I've never met her in person. She has interviewed me for articles in Women's Wear Daily. And, you know, we've talked, you know, she has my cell phone number now. We text back and forth. And it's, yeah, I mean, so there's just such a great way now that you can, you know, through the internet too, if you're in some spot or some place that you or don't have accessibility to learn about the global world. So what advice would you give a young scholar who is, you know, thinking about, you know, I want to study something, I want to make a difference, I want to make an impact with my research, but I also want to finish within, you know, time. I also want to finish that work.
Right. Well, that's narrowing down your topic and not trying to conquer the world with your dissertation. Wish I had thought about that since my dissertation was over 300 pages. But hours we need to be limited, and that didn't happen with my major professor, but that's okay. Yeah, I I think it is, you know, it's working with your faculty mentors, taking your own experiences and coming up with a topic that, you know, you are passionate about, but then really starting to narrow that down from the start. So it's a manageable thing. You have a lot of opportunities ahead of you for research. You know, the dissertation is not the be all end all. If you want to go into faculty, if you want to go into educational research, I mean, you'll have plenty of opportunities in the future. Get your basic research skills taken care of with your dissertation, and then you can work on expanding from there.
Oh, so well said. So well said, because I so agree with you. And I often tell students that, you know, your dissertation is a practice. It is not the end all be all, like you said. You know, it's not like, you know, this is the research for life. No, it's for you to practice and learn to do research and be able to demonstrate that.
Exactly. It's only your first step into what could be a research career. It's definitely not the end. It's the beginning.
Absolutely. I would say also, you know, do some background research on your possible dissertation advisors and see if they, you know, allow you to write a 300-page dissertation.
Yeah, I was very fortunate that I had someone who was quite happy for me to write over 300 pages. Didn't you tell me you wrote like 80 pages one weekend or something when you were writing your dissertation?
Yeah, but I had no life. You know? Yeah, I did. Well, yeah, you have a good memory. Yeah, I did do that.
Hey, I tried that. I was like, well, Yolanda did it. I can do it too. I couldn't. I didn't have it in me. So props to you.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, such great advice to young scholars and, you know, thinking about, you know, getting those good research skills, because you now are really applying, you know, your research skills to a whole different area with your current work in instructional design, but you understand how to do research. So,
yeah. And I would say qualitative research. We have people on the team who are much more well-versed in quantitative than I am. I definitely leave that side of the research house to them.
Well, that's great that you said team too, you know, that collaborative, because I mean, I'm ancient. I've been around a long, long time. And so I remember the days when, like, oh, this newfangled thing, you know, working with qualitative data and, you know, oh, there's the qualitative people, there's the quant people, and, you know, they don't really. But now, you know, I love what you said, that you have a team, you know, you have people that are working with the more quantitative area and qualitative. And there's just that acceptance now, thank goodness, that you can answer a question with both, you know, various ways of gathering data and analyzing it.
Exactly. And I think that's the best research study is going to be mixed methods, because quantitative can tell you certain things, qualitative can tell you certain things, and put them together and you have a much more well-rounded picture. So I shouldn't say I'm just solely a qualitative researcher, but that's only what my experience has been in so far. Mm-hmm. They may help me to be more well-rounded with learning more about statistics and other things that I don't even know what to call them.
I think that continues to change and change and evolve too. But yeah, I agree with you. And it's just nice having, you know, been a person that lived through the battles of quant and qual, you know, that might have to be a paper. Yeah, you know, the Battle of Versailles, you know, the Battle of Quant and Qual or something. I don't know. Okay.
I see those wheels turning.
Unfortunately, you've had way too many conversations where I go down my rabbit holes and things are pink. You're still talking to me. Well, as we, you know, wrap things up, I ask every guest the question, how do you define innovation?
So I've been thinking about this a lot. I looked up the dictionary definition so that, you know, I'd have my starting point. So making changes in something established, especially by introducing new methods, ideas, or product. But then I have to apply my own lens to that as an educator, an instructional designer, a historian. And so I think it's really important to emphasize the historical context and that applying that can help us with continuous improvement. We don't know where we're going until we know where we've been. And we have to think of all of these innovations as an iterative process. And then we take what we've learned in the past, apply it to something in the future, and that can continue to be repeated so that we have a better future.
I love that you've included the historical aspect in there, because I grew up in the household with a person that loved history. Well, both, actually, they both do. But both my parents were just loved history. And so integrating a historical perspective into innovation is so valuable. So thank you for adding that component. And at some point, I would love to have you back to talk about some of your history work, your genealogy work. You touched a little bit earlier about material culture and, you know, learning through that. And I know that you have some really fun projects, because sometimes I get some amazing text messages of pictures of material culture items that you have purchased or collected and the stories behind them. So I would love to have you back to talk about some of those projects too.
Well, it would be my pleasure to talk about my historical research and my collection of material culture. I'm not sure you'll limit me to half an hour or an hour in that case. I could talk to you about that all day.
Be great. Yeah, you know, we'll just keep it going, and you know, there's not a limit on the time at all. Oh, well, Erin, thank you for joining us today on the Innovation Insights podcast. It's been truly just delightful, and I always enjoy our conversations. And I'm sure our audience is going to be completely inspired by your thoughts and insights.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and I look forward to another opportunity to talk to you about my historical research.
Oh, well, don't worry. I have your cell phone number. I know how to find you.
Boy. You know where I live.
And it's not a threat. Some people, I think, have probably changed their numbers. They're like, oh, man. Well, to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. I hope you found this conversation fascinating, and hopefully it shed some light on the unexpected intersections between material culture, gender, education, that whole space of being a maker, and how that can be informed through interviewing and listening to people. So please engage with us through our social media channels and let us know what you think about today's episode, and subscribe to us too and follow us. So as I always ask, that you just keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.